This is the Bloody Disgusting Podcast Network.
Welcome to Nightlight, a horror movie podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Prince, also known as Head Knight, and alongside me, we got Freddy.
Always keeping that spoopy.
Always and forever. David's not here. One, because we are recording this online, and it only allows us four people. But another reason also because he can't really handle blood too much. Fair enough. So he ain't here. You are resting in our minds. Don't worry about it, David. We are a group of knights with an absolute love for film and a passion for horror. This is a podcast that takes a different horror film to break down and discuss the ultimate question, why horror? So hit the lights, sit back, and let the darkness envelope you. You can support the show over on patreon.com/goodnightlife.night with a what?
Okay.
By pledge on Patreon, you have access to the show ad-free and as early as Monday with a post-show. If you don't have any bucks to toss, don't worry. An episode is released every Friday on most podcast services around the world. I tried getting it all in there before I had to, like, swallow. Just, like, trying like to definitely get it all in there, but totally fine. We are still keeping things going with Pride Horror Month with an episode that is actually a film that has been highly requested multiple times, but we couldn't do this alone. We had to invite our sister show on this particular show from the Bloody Disgusting Podcast Network, Horror Queers. We have Joe and Trace. Welcome in.
Hi.
I'm so glad that y'all have had this requested so many times, because so have we.
And oh, really?
Oh, good.
It is very nice to cross this off the list.
Fair enough. Yeah, do it on our show and just send everyone over to us for it.
I am happy to give you that traffic.
I love it. Awesome. Well, the film that we are covering for Pride Horror Month, everybody, is going to be Alexandre Aja's High Tension. First and foremost, thoughts. And I would love for our guests to go first. I know Trace got, like, mad thoughts, but I heard nothing from Joe yet. So I want Joe, please, Joe, do you mind going first of your thoughts of High Tension?
Oh, High Tension. Okay. So this is a controversial film. This is my second time seeing it. The first time I really liked it. I think I probably had it at about a 4 or maybe even a 4.5.
Oh, wow.
I really thought that it had done something fresh and innovative, and I appreciated that people don't like the twist, but I thought, you know what? I'm not bothered by this. And then I went into the rewatch and realized, oh, the only reason I'm not bothered by it is because I didn't know it, and this film has very little rewatchability. So I feel like this film is kind of a definitive one and done, where you watch it, you either enjoy the twist and you think it's innovative, or you think it sucks, and then you're like, and I'm good. I have now done my due diligence. I can cross it off the list.
I dunk my toe in and, you know, the water is lukewarm, but not warm enough. Don't want to get inside. That's fair enough. That's completely fair. Trace, your thoughts, my friend.
Yeah, I don't really like this movie. I saw it when it came out. It hit the States in like, what, 04, 05. So I was about 15, 16 years old. And it was one of those movies that I read about it on Bloody Disgusting. It was like, oh, this is like one of the most violent, shocking films you'll ever see. It's going to be so intense. And I saw it and I was like, okay, like I thought it was fine. I was very annoyed by the twist. I think the version I had at the time, though, was the R-rated cut. So like, it was like 2 minutes of gore were cut out. And so it just, I walked away kind of like, yeah, it's fine. This is my second time watching it. I've owned this Blu-ray for like 7 years because I bought it for $5 one day at Best Buy. And I was like, I'll revisit that one day. Never did. I agree with Joe. We'll talk about the queer aspects and the queer reading of this film, because obviously, like, there are people that appreciate what it's doing with the queer storyline, and there's people that think it's very problematic. And I think it's going to be fun to dive into that. But yeah, while I was like, oh, the twist is kind of annoying, that sucks. The second time watching this, the whole time I was just so annoyed. Like, I when we're going through the plot today, I wish we had like one of those taboo buzzers that you play during Taboo when like someone says the word on the card. Every time like something isn't possible, just like buzz. I think it's very well directed. I think it's wonderfully shot. I think Aja is fantastic. I think the gore is amazing. The performances are good. It is just a terrible fucking script. And I've never been more annoyed rewatching a film than I have this one.
That's so funny. Oh, man. Freddie, now this was your first time watching this.
Yes, and as I try to do the like majority of all the films that we watch, is I try to go in completely blind. The only context I had, again, was that you put in the notes, David, you can skip this. And when I see that note, I know it's going to be fucking brutal. I know I can't handle too much of it. I think, also, I texted you. I was like, oh, yeah, this is a movie that's really testing my limits right now. This is the last time I felt this way was the Poughkeepsie Tapes. And that movie was pretty brutal, too. But at the same time, this movie kind of was a little bit of a mess. And I have to say it's probably because of the writing a little bit. But I didn't really enjoy this movie because there's not a lot to like about it, besides maybe the protagonist being pretty badass in the beginning. And then we get that twist and it's kind of like thrown out the window. It's just like, oh, never mind. But it's one of those movies that my heart couldn't handle too much. So I even tweeted this and some people saw it. I had to watch Ratatouille after this movie. Because that's my feel-good movie. And I was just like, I have to like watch something positive now. But it's one of those things where it's like, I'm glad I watched this like at 7 a.m. It was the best choice I made because then I can have all day of watching movies to kind of like fix it. But like you said, there is some stuff to love about this movie. When the gore hits, the gore hits. There's some good action sequences. And yeah, that's kind of where I stand. I stand like in the middle. It's like, I'm okay that I watched it. But I'm not going to go back and watch this again, well, to be honest.
Go watch it a second time and see how you feel.
You've got 7 years.
Yeah.
I'll give it 7 years. 7 year gap.
It'd be like eight. Yes. After 27 years, maybe. We'll see.
It's interesting because when this movie first came out, I loved this movie. When it first came out, I was like, holy shit, this movie is absolutely insane. And the cut that I saw back in around 2005, 2006 or so was the unrated cut. And when I saw the unrated cut, it was actually a bootleg copy. So, like, I had a really, really shitty copy that didn't have subtitles for me, and it was all in French. And I was like, ah, whatever. Screaming's the same thing in every language. So I was just like, okay, I don't know what the fuck's going on. But it was just super interesting just to kind of, like, see how everything, I guess, worked without even knowing what was, like, I guess, verbally happening. But when I watched it again, which was around 2009 or so, finally I was able to see a cut that was actually dubbed.
And oh, yeah. That's what my copy is.
Yeah. So I think Trace only has the actual, like, version that's not dubbed, which you can only get on Blu-ray. So since you had that version and I assume you watched the dubbed version, correct?
Yeah, it was dubbed. And then they had some subtitles in between. But I saw it on Tubi. Right. Yeah.
Oh, that's the R-rated cut, too, because I checked Tubi.
Yeah, not
Tubi
unrated.
Was the,
yeah.
Yep. So the unrated cut is not available on streaming services at all.
Y'all should have been going to Best Buy 10 years ago looking at the $5 bin.
I mean, luckily, I've seen the unrated version, so I was like, I understand what's happening. I'm piecing everything together, but it definitely made me miss the unrated gore, for sure. But I think I are teeter-tottering around the realms of just like, you know, I don't think I liked this movie as much as I thought I did.
Yeah.
And because I watched it countless of times back in the day. We're not that old. Don't age us all, Prince.
No, but I mean, like, you're right. I mean, like, but the time in 2005, this was something special. I mean, like,
yeah,
it was released in France in 2003. So before we got Saw, before we got Hostel, and I don't really consider this torture porn. It's New French Extremity, but it's like for us in the States, this was something that was like a taboo intensity attention for us.
Ooh, sneaking in the reference to intensity early.
Oh, I actually didn't even think about that. But yes, no, you're totally right. We'll go over that, I'm sure.
Yes, we will. We definitely will be going over that for sure. But yeah, this movie is. Will I watch it again? Probably. I probably would, but
I'll mail you my Blu-ray.
I'll accept it. But I don't think I would watch it anytime soon, just because this time around did leave a bit of a sour taste in my mouth. And I was just at that point, I was just like gawking at the way it was shot and the cinematography and the positioning of the camera and the one shots and things like that. Because I was just like, God, this story is just so fucking problematic. And I had to read a commentary about the story to make it less problematic, but I was just like, I don't like that. To read something to not make it problematic, that sounds backwards to me.
Do we want to save the problematic discussion for when we actually get to the end of the movie, or do you want to have that before? Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Let's do that. Matter of fact, let's just jump into it right now. Yeah. High Tension, directed by Alexandre Aja, released June 18th of 2003 in France. A runtime of 1 hour and 35 minutes if you have the standard edition. A runtime of 1 hour and 42 minutes if you have the unrated.
I'm going to correct you.
Please do.
It is my Blu-ray says 111 minutes, and I was really like shocked by that. No, it is 89 minutes for the R-rated cut, 91 minutes for the unrated cut.
What? Mm-hmm. Okay, so IMDb wrong.
No. Everything listed for it is wrong. But that is the correct. That is the correct one.
All right, we need some Wikipedia credits so we can go ahead and change that, because that needs to be changed. A budget of $2.5 million and a box office of $6.8 million. Don't know if that's globally or not, but I guess. And a rating of 41% on Rotten Tomatoes. We open to our main protagonist, antagonist, Marie, whispering, quote, "I won't let anyone come between us anymore," end quote, over and over in a medical facility in southern France. Her back is gashed, scratched, and bruised. She stops when she hears the camera asking if they are recording. Flashback to her limping through a forest, holding her side as we go through the cast and title sequence. And right off the bat, I was just thinking, like, fuck, this is so 2000s. When I first saw it again, I was like, oh, fuck. Because I haven't seen this since, like, 2011. But I was like, oh, this is so 2000s.
I mean, are we fans of the let's begin the movie with the end of the movie and then... I'm not going to lie. I actually miss, and maybe I'm wrong, because I miss someone asking if they were recording. I swear to God, my version was just Marie just saying, like, I'll never let anything come between us, let anything come between us, and then boom, we're going back.
I think it was just in the English version.
It's in there. It's the briefest of reference, and she says it very quietly, and you don't see another person that she's talking to, so it's just like, are we recording, camera blip, right, and then we're into the woods. And It's already off to a bad start, because if you miss that, then the twist at the end feels like even more of an out of the blue sucker punch. Yes. And like, you need these little finesses to make that twist go down easier.
Okay. You know? I mean, I watched this movie fucking twice. I watched this with the commentary today because I wanted to hear Aja and Gregory Levasseur talk about this movie. And continue, because there's a part coming up that they address, and I'm like, oh my God. So go ahead.
Fair enough. A man in a car is driving down the road enjoying a cigarette until Marie comes out onto the road. It causes him to stop and swerve out of the way. He looks back, but he doesn't see anyone behind him. Trying to start his car again, she startles the man, screaming for help while banging on his window. Cut to Marie waking up unscathed in the backseat of her friend Alexia's car, who I'm probably going to refer to as Alex for like the rest of the time, because I just kept calling her Alex. She asks for a cigarette as Alex continues to drive, handing her a pack and a lighter. Alex mentions that they are they're almost to her parents' house. Marie shares the dream that she just had about her being injured and running away from someone. And I love what Alexia says there, though. She's just like, oh, who was stalking you? What is she like?
But she's like, it was the weirdest thing. It was me.
Right. She's like, the funny thing is, it was me chasing myself. And, you know, back in 2003 or 2005, like, you're like, whoa, wait, what do you mean you're chasing yourself? But in this particular story and this whole aspect, because I assume when she asks in the beginning, are you recording now? I assume she's telling the story.
Yeah. Yes.
That doesn't seem clear.
Yeah. But hey, you're right. But we're also being shown the end of the movie. Right. With Marie and Alex's place. And so it's like, okay, movie, you're just being intentionally obtuse at this point to try to fuck us up. And that's what annoys me so much about this movie. Like, people that like it, and there is, by all means, like this movie, but they're like, oh, but I can let it pass because, it's all in her mind. She's an unreliable narrator. She doesn't know what's real. And I'm just like, yeah, but the editing and the way the movie presents the story is intentionally trying to trick you.
Right. It's trying to be a whole red herring.
Yes. And that's what I hate about it.
Fair enough. Alex asked who the guy was chasing her, but Marie comments that the funny thing is that she was actually running from herself. Alex says that she feels shitty for them partying so much last night. Marie offers to drive so she can get some rest. Not into the idea. She brings up the last time she allowed her to allowed Marie to drive. But Marie is still bitter about Alex ditching her for some guy. And I am curious on the aspect of this. And mainly because I'm more so curious on if you guys think Alex already knew that she kind of had a crush on her, or is this Marie's, I guess, a little bit of toxicity and jealousy coming out?
I mean, definitely the latter.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a problem that the film doesn't really explore that at all. I mean, again, but like, do you want it spoon-fed to you? Do I want it spoon-fed to me? I don't know, but right. Yeah, I would agree with Joe. I think it's the latter.
Okay. They insult each other for a bit before Marie asks what is there to do around in the country. And this is interesting on the English dubbed version. It jumps from both French to English, which I've always thought was just mind-bogglingly odd. Like, it is
so confused me
weird.
So hard. I was like, pick or choose, what movie do you want to be? Like, I could read subtitles, speak French the entire movie, I'm down. But it's like, switching between them, I was like, okay, what's going on?
Lionsgate said no.
That was the weirdest decision to me. The fact it was just like, okay, it's going to be dubbed in English, but every now and then we'll sprinkle a little French from the actors in here.
Keep the very culture in there.
Yeah. Alex reminds her that they are there to study and not party before turning on the radio song Sarah Pouchet the Amour. Marie jumps in the front seat, turning the music down while Alex continues vibing. I don't blame her. Vibe out. They turn it back up and they both sing the music and continuing down the highway. Meanwhile, at Alex's parents' house, her little brother Tom is playing with their dog Hendrix while his mom calls for him. She is grabbing the laundry, telling him to stop shouting and to head inside because he is giving her a headache. I mean, kids. He shares that he's waiting for Alex calling. His mom mentions that she will get there when he... I completely messed that up. He shares that he's waiting for Alex. His mom mentions that she will get here by the time he takes a bath. He whines that he can't because she hasn't seen him in his cowboy costume. She provides a solution for him to go inside, take a bath, and put the costume back on afterwards. He's cool with that. While Tom is yelling and running back inside the house, a man in a truck moaning as he is being pleasured by a severed head. Tossing it out of the window when he's finished of driving off, leaving us with a severed woman's head.
So this is the thing. This is the first time when it's Aja and Levasseur. They're like, oh yeah, so you know, this is Marie telling the story, and like, you know, we're cutting away from anyone that she would have known. Obviously, she's not really in the truck getting blown by this severed head, but it's kind of like she's thinking in her head, what would the killer be doing in this situation or something like that. I don't know. That's and I was stretch. Like, I don't know. You're the writers of this movie. You should know.
You're stretching your own movie out.
Well, barring that aspect of it, I do think that these early scenes are actually very important for setting up the kind of groundwork for the queer reading of this film. Because we're presented to these two girlfriends, and we don't actually know the nature of the relationship. But as you observe, Prince, you can see that there's a kind of tension and, like, you know, we'll get to some slut-shaming and some internalized misogyny and that kind of stuff in the way that Marie treats Alex. But in these early scenes, it's like, it's idyllic. We're seeing the sun. It looks gorgeous. They're having fun singing along to the radio. It's like, these could be girlfriends or something more. And then we cut to this farmhouse, and it's strictly enforced gender norms. Like, mom is outside doing laundry. The boy is a cowboy. It's like these really strictly defined terms that we're expecting to see, which is like, oh, and then Marie's going to come in here and she's going to fuck shit up because she is the queer who will not suffer domestic bliss like this.
And she's also, again, so it's important also that she whether she knows or not, fantasizes herself as a male serial killer, a man with a penis, and she's also fantasizing about the severed head of someone who kind of looks like Marie blowing her figurative penis.
Oh, sure. And there's pictures of other women in that truck, which some people have read as, oh, Marie has potentially done this to other women before, and it's because of her obsession with Alex. Which I'm like, oh, I don't know that the film supports that, but the pictures alone suggest that she has at least observed other women who remind her of Alex.
See, and for me, I was thinking it wasn't Alex specifically. It's just this type of woman. Like, she has a type, and she continuously repeats this cycle with from woman to woman to woman to woman. So Alex is just, like, the latest obsession of hers. Because she would have killed Alex at the end, but she didn't. So I'm assuming that when all these other women rejected her, she killed them.
Quite possibly.
Wow.
Quite possibly.
These are so many great perspectives. I think I do have to watch this twice because of the ending. To be honest, because, like, honestly, as a first-time viewer, I'm just taking it for how it is, right? I thought, like, the perspective of how they wrote these characters, it makes them look like they're a couple. So I thought they were a girlfriend and girlfriend already. And then seeing this killer, I was like, oh, this is just a sadistic killer. But now knowing it's her, that's a completely different perspective that I completely missed as the first-time viewer. Looking at this, the only thing I got out of it, I was like, oh, this is where David would turn this off. That was my only notes about this whole entire scene. And I was just like, oh, wow, this is just a severe intro of someone who's going to be sadistically maybe killing this couple. And that's my first perspective.
No. It's really funny, and I'm not trying to flex my, like, steel-hearted, my steel eyes here, but, like, watching this, I was kind of like, this isn't really as gory as I remember it being.
I remember being shocked and appalled by some of the violence, and here I'm just kind of like, oh, I like it when that guy gets decapitated and the blood goes everywhere.
But yeah, I mean, like, it's that in the throat slash the mom, but other than that, I was kind of like, it's not really, like, quite as just, like, violent as I remember it being. But maybe it's that Texas Chainsaw effect, you know, where people were like, oh, the original Texas Chainsaw is so gory, but it's not at all.
Well, right. I think the movie is shot so well that it feels really tense all the time.
It's also a lot of that film grade that they have on there too with that filter.
Oh, yes,
it makes it very gritty and realistic. And I even put here, it's like, this is solid, very early 2000s style of just, like, indie grit. Yeah, like film style. And that's why it gave me, like, vibes of the Poughkeepsie Tapes. I was like, oh yeah, it feels very realistic, and the gore looks realistic as well. It doesn't look like Hollywood gore.
Sure.
It's not glamorized. It's like, no, this is brutality. Oh, at its best.
I mean, the makeup artist is it's someone who's worked with Fulci, who did a lot of gore effects on Fulci films. So yeah, that it makes sense. And again, that's a highlight of this film. The gore always looks good, like really good. Yeah.
Which is impressive though, because they were not working with a big budget. Like, this film was hard to get financing for because France does not like genre films, and particularly not violent genre films. Because I guess the other important thing for us to acknowledge is that this is part of the new French extremity, and so there's obviously a batch of films that come out around this time period that are very reflective of the socio-political elements that are happening. Shout out to Alex West in her book. But particularly, like, this is one of the early ones that's, like, really aggressively genre-based. Like, the other ones are kind of dramas with horrific elements to them. And this one then comes along and just really fucking cracks everything open. But France hates violence. Like, the way that the U.S. hates nudity and sexuality, it's like you flip it for France. So this was kind of the enfant terrible in France.
But correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like a lot of New French Extremity also has, like, a lot, not all of them, but a lot of them do have, like, a political aspect to the narrative.
Oh, yes.
Whereas this one does not, but this one kind of, like, I don't want to say popularized the New French Extremity, but it made it more, like, globally known that it was happening.
Yeah, the messaging for the politics is more subtle, but that's where the queer angle comes in, is about the repressive conservatism of the country.
There you go.
The women are almost there, Marie looking over at Alex with her eyes closed. She tells Marie to keep her eyes on the road, Marie complimenting her on her looks. And it's so funny because it reminds me of, like, that dumb scene in Too Fast, Too Furious when Paul Walker's looking at him.
out of all the movies, out of all the Fast and Furious movies. No, out of those nine movies, you picked the second one.
That one. I was like, why this? They pull up towards the cornfield. Alex directing her to where to go. They are arguing about Marie being rude to some guy talking to her, but Alex shouts for her to stop the car, claiming that she spotted something in the cornfield. She gets out of the car.
Yeah, this is a cunt move. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that was fucked. Marie calls for her to come back into the car, spooked by her surroundings. As Alex continues, Marie gets out of the car to go after her. She slowly moves through the field, searching and calling for Alex. She cries for her to cut it out, then hears the engine of the car start behind her, Alex driving off. She runs after the car, Alex laughing about her joke, and I would have fucking shit my pants. I would not have liked that.
No, I would have been livid.
I would have been livid. So fucking mad.
Anyone tried to do this to me.
But this foreshadows the kind of cat and mouse game that we're going to get, right? Like, this is Marie going after her friend in the dark.
Yeah. God damn it, this is why we have y'all. They pull up to the house, Marie commenting on how boring the area is as they pull out their bags. Alex's dad, Daniel, opens the door for them while holding Tom and calming down Hendrix. Alex hugs him, introducing him to Marie. Daniel claims that it is nice to see her instead of a photo. And I thought that was kind of interesting. It made me think of how long they've been friends, but until they mentioned the next part, that it was a photo of them at Spain.
And Marie kind of, again, this is Cécile de France is very, is that her name? Cécile de France. Is really good in the role. But yeah, the way she reacts to it, because it's what I've heard called love kernels, where it's like, oh, Alex likes me so much that she has a picture of me at her family home. Oh my God, let me latch onto that shit.
This is literally like she's coming home to meet the family. Like she thinks that this is something way more than Alex intended. And Alex is like, oh, we're here to study.
But, and again, if we're going with this queer angle, she is being dropped into a regular, quote unquote, nuclear family, which helps to set off her psychotic tendencies and, I'm going to argue, internalized homophobia.
Correct.
Definitely agree. Marie is confused, Alex reminding her about their photo from Spain, her dad adding that they have it up on their fireplace. They head inside the house, Alex grabbing... I don't know why I wrote it that way. They head inside the house, Alex grabbing a tired Tom as she greets and carries him. Marie unimpressively looks around the home. She looks disgusted.
She's plotting her killer...
That's what I pictured, too.
No, and I was like, but this is also smart for Aja because he's laying out the geography of this house.
Yes. He says his goodnights so Alex can show Marie to her room. Cut to the ladies and Tom heading up to his room, Marie asking what this home was before. Alex shares that it was an old farmhouse, adding that there are a lot of them in the area. Alex points at her room as she explains how the neighbors felt about them moving around the area. She then points at her parents' room, moves on to take Tom to bed, while she quickly explains that Marie is upstairs in the guest room. Marie watches Alex as she puts Tom to bed, her mom calling out to her. She whispers to Marie that she will meet her upstairs, and she goes into her mom's room to speak with her. Marie heads upstairs to her room, placing her things down, inspecting the room. Cue the aunt's famous mirror jump scare, with Alex standing right in the doorway. She compliments Marie having her own bathroom, then asks if she would like her heater blanket to be on. She tells Alex that it is fine, and Alex asking if she what does she think about the house, and she calls it a dollhouse. The two friends are downstairs, Alex making tea as she talks about a guy that she is into who is in another relationship. Marie doesn't understand her fascination with him, but Alex's logic is that single men make her skeptical and untrustworthy. Marie still believes that men can be assholes towards women, even if they are taken. Putting the dishes in the sink, Alex thinking that he doesn't possibly like her. Marie asks about his girlfriend, Alex commenting that she's Brazilian. Alex chuckles about him being into exotic women as she walks over to pet the parrots. Or Marie chuckles, as he's being into exotic women. Alex asks Marie about her plans to potentially settling down with someone. Marie isn't interested and goes out to smoke a cigarette before bed. Alex reminds her about their studying at 9 a.m. before Marie walks out of the door. She comments that she is happy that she finally was able to meet her family.
It's important to note here that the default assumption, and this is something that queer people have to face all the time, is like the default assumption is that you are always straight. So you always end up having to come out. And this is what I really see in Alex's conversation. It's like, right. It never even occurs to her that Marie might have feelings, even though Marie has been right. dropping fucking hints all day long.
Oh, yeah.
And even the passive-aggressive way that Marie talks to Alex about these men, it's like, it's clearly a jealousy angle. Like, she is uncomfortable with Alex being sexual with men, and Alex never picks up on any of this because she's like, well, we're straight, though, right?
And so right. we're already into, even before we know the twist, like, we're already entering into predatory lesbian, also man-hating lesbian, very much those kind of tropes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
There's a reason why... there are a lot of queer people who do advocate for this film, but there has been some destructive tendencies, like particularly against the idea of like the homicidal or predatory lesbian. Like, a lot of people will hold this film up as an example of a really destructive film. Like, this hurt lesbian, the perception of lesbians.
But I do want to mention, though, that there's... liking it because of that, or liking it because, like, or disliking it because of that, like, it doesn't, it's, there's not really a right or wrong. Like, the situation's a lot more nuanced than that.
Okay, enough. Crazy ex-girlfriend.
I know.
Alex's dad is calling it a night in his office. We're repassing his window, lighting her cigarette. I do love how we actually see that kind of aspect again of when she's kind of running away from herself. She sits down on the dimly lit swing, smoking her cigarette as she lightly swings. All right, fucking story time. So, I grew up in San Francisco, but at a time, my gosh, when I was maybe 13. 12 maybe, I moved to Fresno. And Fresno is this little big town in California that is nothing's truly there. But shout out to everybody in Fresno, I guess. But with that area, the area I lived in was the west portion of Fresno, and it was always dark, and it was very farm-like, and it looks like this. Where people, for some reason, every single person had a fucking swing underneath a tree outside of their home. And every single time I see this, I always think of either one, this movie, or The Muse. Because of this movie.
Wait,
but
The Muse, like, is that a Sharon Stone?
No, the band.
Oh,
yeah, Muse. Because of this movie.
I was like, there's a Sharon Stone movie called The Muse, but it was like a Showtime movie. What a random deep cut.
The Muse. What's going to pop out of my head next? Looking back at the house, she spots Alex is showering above her, now off the swing and back in the house, locking the door behind her. She jogs back into her room, drinking some water from the faucet before shutting off the light and lying down in bed for the night.
Setting the mood for herself.
That she is, with some reggae. So the wind whirls outside the house, causing it to creak around her. She listens to her cassette player to drown the noise as she listens to Runaway Girl while she pleasures herself.
And also Under the Crucifix.
Under the Crucifix, yes. Oh, I'm so glad you actually mentioned that. Meanwhile, the truck from earlier approaches the house. I do personally find this symbolic. And Trace, correct me if I'm wrong, because they may have mentioned this in the commentary, but I do kind of picture this as when the truck is approaching closer, it's kind of the same concept as her
climax.
Climax.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah, 100%. Okay. I mean, you know, and yeah, when you know the twist, it's so on the nose at this point where it's like, okay. And again, like, this is fine. Like, all of the... even knowing the twist, the only thing that doesn't make any sense is the goddamn severed head bit. But the fact that the killer arrives or her murderous tendencies surface as she's feeling sexual thoughts for another woman is very much key. And again, you can read that as, okay, cool, which it's just a person who has internalized homophobia and is that is manifesting in psychotic tendencies. Or... not.
Everyone else in the house is sound asleep as the truck motors to a stop in front of the house. Hendrix is barking at the front door as the light beams on the front door. Marie finishes hearing Hendrix downstairs barking. She takes out her headphones, looking outside her window, but she doesn't see anyone. The doorbell rings, Alex's dad waking up from the constant buzzing from a man with dirty hands. He comes down the stairs, answering the door. Marie looks above from the window, the killer striking Daniel in the face with a razor.
So I did want to just make a quick note, because this is kind of the first time we really get to see Philippe Nahon. And Tracy mentioned earlier that, yes, Marie imagines herself as this man. This wouldn't mean anything to North American audiences, but Philippe Nahon kind of looks like France's most notorious serial killer.
Yes, he does. Very much so. That's that. Every single time I see him, it always gives me chills because of that. Is that our door? Oh, that was weird.
I think it's an office space. It's haunted at night.
And I won't do this the whole time, I promise. But again, the way that I wrap my head around this is like, okay, I don't think she ever went inside. I don't think she ever actually masturbated. I'm going to say that she stayed on that swing. She was having sexual thoughts.
Yeah.
And stayed outside, which is how she ends up on the at the door. How there's a truck involved, I don't know. But that's my take on it.
I don't think most of this is meant to be taken literally. This is what she imagines the scenario plays out like. But in reality, she probably just murdered the family and then she drove somewhere with Alex.
Right, but again, the truck exists, and Alex is in the back of this truck for a good portion of the movie, and I don't know how the truck gets there when she's with Marie the whole time, when she's with Alex the whole time.
The truck doesn't exist. This is all Marie being like, and then we did this, but none of it is
the
real.
The unreliable narrator.
I love it. He lets himself inside the house, killing Hendrix. Bastard. Marie continues listening from upstairs in fright as Daniel tries crawling up the stairs. The killer slowly approaches him, using his boot to shove his head through the stairway banister. The man grabs the dresser, sliding it, decapitating the head.
So good. For your Freddy, the R-rated cut, basically you do after the head it gets like, I mean, it's a longer shot of the head getting but you also there's you a longer the shot of blood just spraying out of the neck wound.
Yeah. And like I told you, the version you watched is pretty tamed compared to the unrated version.
It's about a minute and 40 seconds of gore that's cut for the R-rated cut.
Damn.
Yeah, because this scene is like so good in the unrated scene, and then it's still good.
I was about to say it's still brutal. My first time watching it, I was like, "Holy
shit!" You still see his head bend, and you definitely see all that stuff still.
The camera lingers. There's a lot more lingering in the unrated cut.
Right.
Yes. Yeah, and there's definitely scenes like that. We'll talk about the closet scene of like what happens with the girl's neck. I was like, "Oh man, this is staying here for a very long time." Okay, I'm still here.
That's the big one.
But this was a good kill. I have to say, it was very creative. I was like, "Oh, he's not done," and then just like pushes his head through the stairs. And I was like, okay, at least it's creative, but I'm kind of like tensing up already, but I'll take it.
It's also, I mean, this movie, it doesn't hit the ground running because we do have 20 minutes, but this is like the 20 minute mark of the movie. So it's like, all right, movie, like, let's go.
Meanwhile, Alex's mom wakes up from the commotion. She goes she goes outside of her room to listen more. Tom opens his door, asking what the noise was. Mrs. Sorrell urges him to go back into his room as she continues to call for Daniel. She walks down the stairs, seeing her husband's decapitated body and the killer approaching her with the blade. I truly, deeply do want to know, like, what is going on in their mind when they actually see that Marie. It's Marie.
Yeah.
And I'm very curious. It's just like, yo, what the fuck are you doing? Like,
We get that from Alex the whole time. I mean, again, the way the movie gets around this kind of twist thing is that it keeps Alex gagged. But she's clearly terrified of Marie every time she's near her.
When she hugs her and things like that, like, Marie is definitely shriveled up and is just like, no, please stop touching me.
Well, I think it's why the mom doesn't flip out more. Because normally you'd be like, you're seeing the decapitated body of your husband.
Right.
Like, clearly he is dead. And yet she seems uncertain about what it is that she's seeing, and it's because the killer is someone that she welcomed into her house earlier.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's more like, it's like she's processing it still, even though. Right. Like, also, I'm just like, okay, if I walked in and saw the decapitated corpse of my husband, like, I mean, the head's not really there, so she just sees the body with no head. So she's probably like, what is this thing that's on my staircase?
Why are you lying down, Daniel? Get up.
That's Scary Movie 3. Are you okay? Are you okay?
Like, what are you doing? Have you lost your head? Jesus. Sorry, the pun started.
Marie runs back into her room, listening to the screams from Mrs. Sorrell. She notices a phone, grabbing it, looking for a phone jack around the room. With all her might, she tries to move a wardrobe out of the way. The killer opens the door to the stairs, waking up towards her. She skillfully moves the dresser back, wrapping the phone up and placing it back on top of the dresser, grabbing her belongings, hiding them underneath the bed, and begins to make the bed herself. She runs into the bathroom, drying the sink with a towel and checking the bathtub. The man opens the bedroom door, wiping the blade on his pants as he stares into the room, checking the heater, then bed, and lastly, the bathroom. He touches the faucet with his absolutely disgusting hand, and a droplet of water appears on his finger. Opening the shower curtain, but nobody there, he heads back into the room, moving the mattress to see if Marie is hiding underneath. She moves her feet out of the way, holding her mouth to not make a sound. The man is about to leave, but goes back inside once more to double check. He closes the door, waiting for a few moments to see if he hears anything. Once he is officially gone, she releases her hand, gasping as she tries to catch her breath.
This is a really good, like,
sequence.
This is a really good suspenseful set. I mean, again, we're talking about Aja's direction here. Like, this is masterful.
Yeah, this is fucking incredible. Yeah. I absolutely love this scene so much.
This is probably my favorite scene of the whole movie, to be honest.
It's so goddamn intense.
And then when the ending happened, I was like, oh, so that never happened. Gotcha. Okay.
Well, and that's the thing. If you can ignore that, if you can get past that on a rewatch and just be like, okay, I know none of this is real, but like, I'm still appreciating what's happening. 100%. I mean, when he lifts the corner of the mattress and he check, but she smartly like pulled her feet up to where her feet won't show. Although if he had lifted the whole mattress, she would have been kind of fucked because it's not really him,
right? Right.
But and that's the thing. Like for some reason, my brain cannot let this go on a rewatch. I'm just like, but this is like a waste of a movie because none of this is real.
Right. I thought it was extremely clever. I've heard like literally clean up everything to make it look like no one was there. And then you see the killer come in, and I was like, this killer is very intelligent, too, because he's checking all the things that she cleaned up. And I was like, okay. But then now knowing the ending, it's like, oh, it all makes sense because she's the same person. That's what the person would do.
Yeah,
and that's why she did the actions.
What he would do.
Yeah.
Right? The only reason she's smart is because she's predicting her own decisions.
But I do think one of the other things that comes out of this, so one of the reasons that some queer people do like this film is because it encourages us to empathize with a very like queer-coded woman. So a lot of people just automatically default Marie to a lesbian. And in that regard, like we are 100% on her side, right? Because she is smart. She is savvy. She is the final girl all the way up until the twist reveal.
Right.
So, you know, like I know Stacey Ponder of Gaylords of Darkness has like a really good piece on this film where she says this movie is doing everything to make sure that we are 100% on board with this queer woman. So it's not homophobic to make us cheer for her because she is smart and savvy.
Right. Cut to Alex asleep with earbuds in her ears, the killer caressing her face and then slowly placing the blade around her neck, shushing her to not make a sound. Back upstairs, Marie can hear Alex's muffled screams and the man grunts. She tries back for the phone, moving the dresser out of the way for the outlet. Moved enough, it is a fucking TV plug instead. It's like, oh, bummer. She begins to cry, gaining enough courage to head out of the room. Carefully moving down the stairs, we hear more muffled cries of Alex with chains rattling. Marie runs inside Alex's parents' room looking for her phone. She can't find it, hiding inside of a closet when she hears someone inside the room. Mrs. Sorrell crawls into the room, grabbing the cordless phone off the vanity. The killer comes behind her, slitting her throat. She falls to the floor, Marie covering her ears and trying to look away as the man grunts and growls as he cuts into her flesh. He gets up, wiping the blade, walking confidently out of the room, blood dripping from the shutters of the closet, Marie silently sobbing inside. Marie slowly gets out of the closet, going up to Mrs. Sorrell. She is startled by her gasping and whispering something into her ear, even though it doesn't pop up for us. It doesn't.
So it does for me. Okay. Yeah, my subtitle. Okay. Yes. She says why. That is what she says. So she.
Which, you know what? I think she does. I think that did pop up for me too. Actually, now I think about it, but I'm not sure.
But again, like, because Freddie, if you don't know the ending, like that's like, oh, like what is she asking why? But now that you know the ending, you're like, oh, she's asking her.
It. Yeah.
Like it's also like again, I'm imagining like, okay, so she slit her throat, walked out of the room, switched back to Marie,
came back,
and was like, oh my god, and this woman's like dead. Like why? Why did you do this? Why is this happening? Why did you
come back?
Yeah. Why are you back? Go away.
You've done enough. Leave me to fucking die in peace.
And this neck piece is great. And like the shot where we just see the blood spraying on the white closet, like that to me honestly was more effective than even the actual like slitting of the throat.
And I love the shot of her, like it slows down where her eyes are matching like the slits of the closet too.
Mm-hmm.
That's gorgeous to look at. I was like horrified and like wow, as a filmmaker or like someone who likes filmmaking, it's like this is a great shot, but I'm horrified.
It did it.
The best of both worlds.
It literally did its purpose, which was great.
You can also feel a lot of homages. I mean, like, we'll get one for The Shining later, but, like, this also feels very, like, Halloween, right?
Yeah,
or Tenebrae totally. To me.
Yeah, oh, yes,
absolutely. Oh, yeah, Tenebrae too. Yeah, absolutely.
Or if you're a video gamer, Silent Hill 2, when you first encounter Pyramid Head.
That is true. Marie grabs the phone next to her severed hand, trying to phone for the police, but the line isn't working. She hears a door slam. She sees through the window that Tom is running out of the house as the killer slowly follows him. Marie leaves out of her mom's room looking for Alex. She finds her chained and gagged and runs to hug her and tries to help her. And that's when we're actually getting her scene. Just like okay, don't fuck you.
Please touch me.
Please stop touching me. First too fast, too furious. Now this. They hear Tom outside screaming for his mom as he runs into the cornfield. Marie watches from outside the window, the killer grabbing a shotgun from the back of his truck. Tom is crawling through the field away from the man as two gunshots are heard ringing out through the field. Marie tries to console Alex, trying to get her to calm down enough to tell her where she can find another phone. Alex sobs as Marie tells her that she will be back and that the man can't know that someone else is in the house. Yeah, it's other.
No, I'm just like, okay, so she's in this room with Alex, but she sees the killer go outside, but like, Alex is, okay, it's all in her head, whatever, but like, the killer's in the cornfield, she's in the room, like, whatever.
Yeah. She runs down the stairs, surprised at Daniel's lifeless body around a puddle of blood, running inside the kitchen trying for the phone as the killer walks back into the house. The wire is cut. She hears Alex screaming upstairs as she is being carried out of the house by the man. Marie watches in the shadows as he continues taking Alex to a place inside his truck. It's interesting, like, in the shadows where she's like, very much reminds me of Event Horizon. Like, this is my home now, when he's, like, going back into the shadows. Or is In the Mouth of Madness. I believe that's what it
that's
is.
Right.
In the Mouth of Madness.
Yeah.
I was like, wait.
Yeah, In the Mouth of Madness. When he's going back and he's like, oh, this is my home now.
Yeah.
It's
Sam Neill. You got the right actor.
Right. Thank you. Support. Marie is looking for a weapon. I came back in the end. Marie is looking for a weapon, making so much damn noise, but eventually pulls out a knife to... of the block, which I was just like, why didn't you just go for the knife block? Whatever.
She can't kill herself.
That's true.
No, she can. But the killer heads back inside the house, slowly looking for Marie, trying the back door, but it is locked. Marie on the outside of the house, having the knife at the ready and the keys in her hand. She goes to check the other window, the man walking past. She takes the opportunity to continue moving across the walls and make it back to Alex. The killer is walking around the living room, picking up one of their family photos, rubbing Alex's face, cracking the frame so he can carve out her face from the photo. Meanwhile, Marie is outside the house, making it to Alex, trying to help her out of her restraints. The man comes out of the house, Marie ready with the knife. He closes the door, locking it from the outside, driving off with the two women. As he flees, we get all our kill confirmations of the family in the house and also one outside of the house, except for the dog.
The overhead shot, because I actually love the crane shot where it's like we see the truck driving off. I'm sorry, the truck that doesn't exist driving off. And then it cranes
they're just walking
up
away.
And we see, because we don't see the boy die, which again, I'm surprised. Like, as brutal as this movie is, we don't actually see the child get killed. But we do get that great crane shot of like just seeing his body at the end.
Yeah, if you want dead kids, you got to wait for murders.
Yep.
That's true. it's interesting, too, because when we get that crane shot over Tom's body, it looks like it's only one bullet hole in the back, but there was two shots.
He probably missed. I'm sorry, she probably missed.
Yeah.
That's what I was thinking. I was thinking that she possibly missed, but I was also thinking, like, wait, where did she get the gun from?
She's skilled with a straight razor. She's not skilled with a shotgun.
Fair
but
enough.
At the same time, having her being the unreliable narrator, she could just make all of this up. Maybe she just killed everyone while they were sleeping.
The whole movie could not be real.
That's true.
She could just be insane in the insane asylum, and that's it. That's the movie.
Right.
She just made up a bunch of killings.
Which this whole house that's scene true. In general very much is Amityville horror. Right. Yeah. And so like it definitely depicts that same aspect of killing the family in their sleep kind of concept. The man drives his dusty truck down the highway playing the radio. Marie tries to use the knife to break them out of the truck. Alex is crying and wailing in the back of the truck, Marie whispering that she has to be quiet. It's just like, why? You're the one doing this to me. She continues wailing, moving into a fetal position. Marie goes down with her, sharing some words of encouragement for their escape. They notice the blood and scratch marks on the ceiling of the truck, Marie sharing that those girls were alone. The man places his trophy photo of Alex next to the photos of other victims as he has a slight smirk. He continues driving while drinking. Don't do that. Marie works on the back door with a few tries and gets the back door unlocked. He pulls into a gas station, filling the truck up. Marie carves out of the window tent, spotting the attendant inside the station. She hands Alex the knife so she can go inside. Marie sneaks on to a message from our sponsors. Marie sneaks out of the car as he continues to fill it. She tries to head for the attendant inside. The pump stops as she runs inside the shop, startling the attendant, Jimmy. I love that his name is just Jimmy.
Jimmy. A very French name.
But played by Mr. Frank Calhoun, who is the director of P2 and the Maniac remake and the not very good Amityville The Awakening with Bella Thorne.
That was
no way. Good, right?
There you go. Full circle.
Too Fast, Too Furious.
And The Muse, starring Sharon Stone.
Fuck it. And Showgirls. She asks for him to phone the police. The killer coming inside the house. She runs towards the back, watching their interaction. The man greets Jimmy, asking how he's. Blah, blah, blah. The man greets Jimmy, asking how he is, and then walking towards the back of the store while asking if he's there alone.
So
I'm picturing her asking him this.
So what's interesting, because some people see another queer element here because it's like there's something about the way that the killer asked Jimmy, like, how do I look with the sunglasses? And he actually touches his hand before he asks him to go open the liquor cabinet.
Yes.
So in a way, Marie has tried to like externalize her queerness by saying like, oh, OK, I'm going to project this man. But she still can't lose all of that kind of residualness. Like she's still imagining homosexual encounters, even with this killer.
Yeah, I was gonna say that. Yeah, because in her male identity, whatever you want to call it, like she's still finding ways to be attracted to a member of the same sex.
Mm-hmm. Right. Now, I'm curious on this aspect. Would you consider that being lesbian, or would you consider that being just non-binary at that point?
I mean.
Because it is that aspect of flipping from her, I guess, from her eyes, even seeing herself as a man as she's trying to get away from herself being a man, where I think, Joe, you said it earlier, where it's kind of like she's trying to run away from her own sexuality in a way.
All you can do is speculate at this point, though, because the film doesn't give anything. And I mean, honestly, there is probably a trans reading of this film somewhere too. Yeah. There has to be. But I, again, as to what that like, I don't know. I don't know how to read that. I don't know where I would begin to even delve into that.
Yeah, like some people have deliberately said, we're not going to try to label who or what Marie is because she doesn't ever tell us. All we know is that she's attracted to Alex.
That's where the queer umbrella comes in, though, and it becomes kind of easier, I'm sorry, with quotes, just because it's like, okay, well, yeah, don't worry about labeling her as lesbian or non-binary or trans. She's just queer. She's in this umbrella.
Yeah.
She's one of these things. We just don't know. Granted, this that queer wasn't really as prevalent of a term in, like, in terms of, like, a good term back in 2003, but, you know, there you go. It was there.
They continue their conversation about Jimmy being alone, tending to the shop as the killer stalks the aisles. The killer considering this being a good place to bring a woman as he goes over the tool section. And it's interesting because Jimmy definitely is uncomfortable with the conversation. But if we even take the aspect of this all being fake away and Marie actually speaking to him about this, that can be a kind of a shocking thing for him to probably picture, where it's just like, oh, I mean, a woman is talking to me this way. It may be interesting for him.
Right. Well, and again, he looks at her to be like, oh, yeah, I'll hide you from this killer.
Right.
But again, it's so weird. It's no just sense. Her story. Yeah. She's lying.
Yeah.
Unreliable narrator.
He comes back to the register trying on some sunglasses. Jimmy notices the blood that is stained on his hand. The man asks how he looks. Jimmy, extremely nervous and uncomfortable, stutters through his answers. He is about to reach for his gun. The man touches his hand, asking how much he owes him. And just as Joe mentioned earlier, he touches his hand quite sensually. Mm-hmm. Jimmy nervously shares the price and the man asks for a bottle of alcohol as well. He walks over to the cage, unlocking it while trying to check to see if Marie is still back there. He signals her while grabbing the drink, turning around to the man standing in front of him, asking for a different type of drink. He goes to grab that second drink, turning around to an axe to his chest, the man grunting as Jimmy gurgles in pain.
There's your Shining reference, by the way.
Yes, it is.
There it is. Which, even The Shining, when they did this in The Shining.
Such a bad move.
I fucking hate it.
Yeah.
I fucking hate it. And my skin color can probably attest to this. Jimmy falls to the floor. The killer pushes the axe deeper into the chest of with his foot. I did like that, though.
That was great. That's the brutality. I mean, it's not even, like, particularly gory. It's just, yeah, he just steps this guy. I think I wrote in my notes, like, he steps him onto the axe.
Fucking brutal as all hell. He walks to the door, turning the open sign to close and shutting off the power. Marie is trying to find a way to escape, but the door is locked. She continues running, going to hide in the bathroom stall. The man is walking around the shop, asking what Jimmy was looking at as he searches. I even fucked up my own way of what the retro speaking of this. He pushes each stall door open. She isn't inside. He goes to the men's room, Marie trying to silence her cries as he uses the bathroom. And I like that she's actually in the men's bathroom because that kind of goes to the whole concept.
It's again. Another instance of the gender flipping. Yeah.
Right. Once done, he walks out of the bathroom. Marie looks out to not seeing him. She smiles for a moment, but still cautious as she leaves out of the stall. With heavy breaths, she slowly approaches each stall, smiling when she confirms that she is alone. Going over to the sink to frantically wash her face, she hears the man driving away. She runs to the front desk to call the police. She explains the whole situation to an officer on the other end. He asks which gas station is she at, and she is looking for something. She is looking for something that may have the name of the station. I think in this moment, just so I could try to make sense of all of our narrator here.
Sense?
What is this thing? I think the whole concept of her calling the cops and things like that and her flipping back, because I do believe she called the cops.
Yeah.
But I think this was just Alex driving away and her trying to get back to Alex.
Yeah.
And I that's what I picture, at least. Like, her going inside and doing all this whole whatever fucking charade. I don't know what she was...
Well, we'll never fucking know.
That's true. Yeah. Thanks, Aja.
My perspective on it, as, like, the first time you were now knowing the ending, I think the gas station never really happened because she can't look for the name because there is no name
camera,
to be
told.
Yeah. And I have to say this, and this is another thing. This is another scene that I felt was a very powerful, strong filmmaking scene where it's like they created high tension, there's a great kill in it, And I have to say, the lighting in this movie is pretty spot on. It's really gorgeous to look at. And they do great cinematography of like following her through the aisles and the guy coming through, and the conversation is pretty intense. There's some great moments in the scene. And just, yeah, now it's making me angry thinking about like it's all thrown away because
the unreliable narrative. I'm glad that you think that. I mean, I literally told someone today, I was like, if I could, I would happily rewatch this movie again if I could forget the twist and at least have the first 78 minutes of this movie as a fresh watch so I could enjoy. Because, yeah, this set piece is very tense. The problem is just because I know it's not real. Like, my brain will not.
Correct.
I didn't
can't unsee it.
I will never feel the tension in this scene again outside of the first time I saw it. Right. Because my brain just constantly is going, well, none of it's real. And so that's the problem for me. That's my barrier. Fair.
That's completely fair. No luck. She then describes the truck, but no license plate number. They argue for a moment because he has a lack of information. Marie hanging up on the cops.
Terrible cop.
Terrible. But I do love this scene, too, as like a first time watch. If you don't know the twist, this is...
This is her trying to make it all up.
Well, but it's also hinting at the extreme anger and passion that she feels, right? So, like, the way that she reacts on the phone, you just think, oh, she's capable of violence and really strong outbursts of anger.
Mm-hmm. Right. Oh, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. She grabs the gun underneath the counter, looking for keys to the attendant's car. She peels out in this Ford Granada sporting the Confederate flag on the back in France.
We all love that, don't we?
Fucking choice. And I even put here, I was like, for my secondary notes, no idea why this is here, but I assume it's a Dukes of Hazzard reference. She speeds down the highway as Newborn by Muse plays on everywhere. It's just, it plays multiple times in this
that
movie.
Needle drop was so surprising to me, but I forgot that it closes the movie too, so it's like...
Right. The man pours alcohol on Alex, then lighting a cigarette. He holds the match over her, laughing at her fear. Marie is right behind the truck. He turns onto a road, Marie passing him and waiting a moment before turning off her headlights to follow him. She watches for a moment before following him into the wooded area, back with Alex, trying to find some sense of hope.
I'm sorry, wait. So, again, with this fucking car chase, I'm just like, so, okay, I'm imagining Marie in the interrogation room. I'm sorry, whatever the fuck room she's in the beginning of this movie. Just like, well, the way that the story actually happened is really boring. Because, yeah, I just killed all these people while they were sleeping. There was no high tense car chase. So let me make one up and just tell you about it.
But you're assuming that she's rational and that she hasn't, like, played this out like a movie in her mind.
Right. Yeah, maybe. I'm just like, okay, let's car chase with no one.
I love it.
That's a good point. It's like we are watching the movie she created for us.
No, that's
so interesting.
Yes.
Yeah. No, it is. Marie loses his trail but continues looking for him. The truck is behind her now, bumping into her car. He holds out the bullets to her gun, pouring them on the ground. I'm like, I personally wouldn't have seen that if someone was hitting me. I would not be constantly checking behind in the
mirror.
She's
like there. Looking in the side mirror like,
like,
oh, wow.
Fucker. Like, this guy is intelligent.
Like, I'm just like, that road is narrow. There's no overhead lighting. Like,
you're in the woods.
Your eyes on the road.
She's fucking, let's go. Like, okay.
That's why you crash, bitch.
He chases her through the wooded area, crashing into the back of her car any chance he got. Marie flips her car on a tree, the man pulling his car over. Marie crawls out of the burning car, groaning in pain. She limps into a conveniently abandoned greenhouse tent, which she then stops limping later in the film and then starts limping again.
Switching personalities.
That's fair. Finding a cloth, she wraps her arm to the best of her ability. The light of the man's flashlight is shined on her face. She moves into another area to hide. He heads inside. Marie pulls a barbed stake out of the ground, twirling the rest of the barbed wire onto the stick. She waits for his light to get closer before she goes hunting for him. Moving closer to his light, being placed as bait dangling from an area. And she's like, oh, fuck, I got myself. Behind her, the man places a clear tarp over her face. She fights to breathe as she holds it tighter and tighter until she goes completely unconscious. He moves down towards her, feeling and taunting her with the blade. You got something?
No. Say what happens next. Okay. This has to be something. Okay. What happens next?
This is interesting. He asks what she wants with Alex as he places his fingers in her mouth. He continues wondering if she turns her on too. Marie frantically looks for something to hit him with as she moves his fingers in and out of her mouth.
Yeah. Okay. So like we're going with this internalized homophobia argument. So it's like, okay, so it's literally Marie staring down her internalized homophobia and confronting it and attacking it, which, again, that's actually a really empowering concept. Yeah. I mean, I've talked on our show, and Joe as well, about how we both experienced in our youth internalized homophobia. And it's something that's so prevalent within the queer community. So watching this actually is something empowering, for me at least, where I'm like, oh, even because you don't know really until you know the twist, but like this is something that works for me when it's like, okay, like she is fighting this. She doesn't really, obviously she doesn't know what's going on. Like she doesn't know this isn't really happening, I guess. But I think it's something interesting. But then, yeah, we have.
Yeah, there's a conflation of like violence with sexualized pleasure as well, which is like, you know, when he's asking her, oh, do you like Alex? Does it turn you on? Like he's also stroking her with the switchblade around her like underwear line. And I don't know. We've talked about like dangerous sexuality a number of times as well. And this, I mean, I think if you take it at face value, it's the threat of rape or sexual assault from a man to a woman. But if you look at it, yes, as her working through her issues, it's like she sees sex and pleasure and desire as a violent act, which again helps to explain why she has created this dissociative break.
And for me, it's also the fingers in the mouth is more like it's hey, you need to be fellating this phallic object, because you as a woman, that is what you're meant to do. And so that's also why, yeah, it's her homophobia saying, yeah, suck on this phallic object, which is his fingers, but still.
Right.
Dirty,
wow. Which can correlate with the headless blowjob earlier on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Wow. Absolutely. She finds a rock hitting him on the side of his head as she gets up bashing his head with the barbed wire. This looks great. She checks his breathing to make sure he's dead. Not me. You're going down. Face is pummeled.
This is so therapeutic, though. Like, watching her take about a dozen swings at him is great.
Oh, yeah.
It's fucking magnificent. But he grabs her by the neck. She suffocates him with the tarp, screaming in both exhaustion and victory. We cut to the police coming to the gas station, radioing that the lights are off. One of the police checks the front while another runs around the back. Now, Trace, on this whole portion here, it's all in French for us.
Oh.
Yeah, so this whole aspect is all in French for us. And then the dubbing comes later when Marie is back with Alex.
But you get subtitles for the French, right?
We do. Yeah. It's
so weird, though. What?
I don't know the choice. The only thing I can think of is that they weren't able to get the dubbed voice actors for everyone.
Yeah, maybe.
That's the only thing I can think of.
Oh. Okay, yeah, Lionsgate. Lionsgate was in their infancy at this point. They couldn't afford it.
That's true.
I read they actually spent like $14 million marketing this movie.
Yes.
But it made like, what, $3 million in the States, I think? So.
Right, yeah. The captain heads inside, finding Jimmy, telling his other officer to call the DA. He plays back the tape from earlier in the evening, Jimmy taking out alcohol and getting axed by Marie. Cut to Marie opening the back of the... I love how she's just, like, looking in the camera, too.
This is the reveal. This is 78... There's 10 minutes left of this movie. This is the big reveal. I would have loved to have seen this with the festival crowd and just hearing all of the what the fucks in that theater.
So it's important to note, too, that this went through a couple of different iterations. So originally it was going to be a lot more obvious that this was Marie telling her story, and therefore we should be a little bit less trustworthy of it. There was a draft where she and the man actually were completely different, and they were told, like, no, you should smush the two of them together. And then originally Aja wanted to just have it that, like, the ending was the reveal that she had been lying the whole time, and that would be, like, the twist at the very end. Like, the movie closes with the reveal that she was the killer, and then
Luc Besson, awesome,
who is the guy who basically helped to get the financing through because of his extreme popularity with...
Wait, Luc Besson?
Yeah.
Oh, cool. Sorry. I didn't know that. Someone pointed out the woman that plays Alex. She's the blue opera lady alien from Fifth Element.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She was married to Luc Besson. That's why.
Right. Yeah, so he helped to finance this film because he had kind of broken genre ground in France, and he had the kind of clout. So he backed this film, and he told them, no, you should do the twist earlier, and you should have it be, you should then have this finale so that we can see Marie and the killer being interchanged, so you can bring the killer back.
I'm telling you right now, if we had gotten the, her saying, I lied to y'all the whole time, but, like, you know, not dumb like that.
Right.
Honestly, I think I would like this movie more.
It's a more conventional twist that we're familiar with. The way it's structured right now is very unique, which in some ways makes this film more memorable. But I do think you're right, Trace. I think it automatically means people get more pissed off at it.
Yeah.
Right. And I mean, it's hard to say, like, oh, that's what Aja was going for. Because I truly, deeply don't know what the whole concept of wrapping it like this, because I feel like this should have been seen that a lot of people probably weren't going to want to rewatch this again, because it's just like, well, I know the twist and I know all of this is fake, unless you are there for the kills. Like, I'm strictly here for the gore concept.
Right. You know what, though? Someone tweeted me last night and compared it to a different movie, and I'm going to spoil it. I mean, maybe I won't spoil it. They compared it to the twist in Identity.
Right.
And they were like, yeah, it's the same thing where it's like, well, you're telling me with this twist that I shouldn't care about any of these characters. And for some reason, the twist in that movie, I am not as angry about, because
we've had our talks with Identity too.
But the way it is presented, like, works better for me. Like, I know watching Identity, okay, none of this is real per se, but, like, it's still, like, I don't know, it works in a way that this one doesn't, and I don't know if it's because of the way the twist is presented. I have to rewatch Identity because I haven't seen it in a while, but, like,
I've only seen Identity once as well. It definitely didn't stick with me as much as High Tension.
Well, and this is maybe not something for us to say, but from my perspective of somebody who is not struggling with mental illness, I think Identity is probably a little bit offensive, but it didn't.
Oh, yeah.
It didn't seem as bad to me as the way that mental illness is stigmatized in High Tension in its relationship to queer sexuality, which for me is like, oh, we're back in this fucking familiar ground where it's like, and if you're queer, you are also homicidal.
I'm sorry. I don't want to, like, keep stopping you from talking, Prince, but
No, this is fine.
I do know, because Joe and I come under a lot of fire sometimes when we call something problematic. Like, we had an episode in Silence of the Lambs come out a month or two ago, and people got so mad, because, like, why are you trying to tarnish this movie because you're saying it's problematic? Like, we talked about his transphobic legacy, and I want to point out that, obviously, when you're talking about a movie, be it from 2003 like this, or 1991 like Silence of the Lambs, or anything, like, anything, you can say something is problematic in a film and still like said film.
Yes, exactly. Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
And I feel like a lot of people think that when people call something problematic, they're saying,
never watch it again.
Yeah, you're judging me because I like this movie even though it's problematic. When it comes to something like High Tension, something we got from Silence of the Lambs too, was people were like, oh, well, honestly, like, don't you want to be treated equally, like, you queer folk? So obviously, can't a queer person be evil? Yes, absolutely. Do I believe that a queer person could have a lot of mental issues and therefore go on a killing spree because of their internalized homophobia?
Yes, I
do believe that. The issue is this, though. When you have a marginalized community and you have people that, I mean, like, that don't know gay people. I'm sorry, they probably do know a gay person. They just don't know that they know a gay person.
Sure. Fair enough.
The thing is that a lot of media is what feeds their perception of what this community is like. Mm-hmm. So yes, while it's totally in the realm of possibility that this would happen, I mean, maybe not this exact situation, but like, like a queer person could be a murderer. The problem is when you see so many portrayals of it like that, people that grow up in the Bible Belt that quote unquote don't know a queer person, that's what they associate with it. And that's where harmful, like, negativity towards a minority group comes from, because they're like, oh, that's just like that trans person is just like Buffalo Bill. Oh yeah, this evil lesbian. Like, a lot of lesbians are like that. No, we should trust people, obviously, to look beyond that. But unfortunately, that's not the case. And so, I just want to make it clear that when you call something out as problematic, it's not necessarily a full condemnation of the piece, but it's an analysis that I think needs to be said.
Yeah.
Right.
And I can say that the impact of this film continues to be felt. Like, I just reviewed a Canadian lesbian survivalist thriller film, The Retreat. It came out last month. And the filmmaker and the screenwriter, sorry, the director and the screenwriter, it's two lesbian women, and they both explicitly reference this film in all of their interviews as saying, this is why we wanted to have a lesbian couple at the center of our film, because we were tired of seeing these kinds of negative, like killer lesbian tropes. So it's like, we're talking about a movie that gets made 17 years later, and these women are saying, like, yeah, I'm still feeling the ramifications of a high tension.
Yeah.
Right. Goddamn. Mm-hmm. Cuts to Marie opening the back of the truck with a smile for Alex. Alex is whimpering in the corner as Marie comes inside the truck, hugging her and claiming that it's all over, Alex. Don't worry.
we haven't really talked a lot about any of the performances so far. I do think we need to give a shout out to Cécile de France, because the way that she switches gears here and she is almost manic level excited, and it's a completely different level to her performance that I just think is like, oh, she is unfortunately completely out of her mind.
Yeah.
Do y'all like that we actually get the return of the male actor killer after the reveal?
No.
Yeah, I didn't. I wish it was her.
I kind of hate it. I wish that it was her in what we're about to get to.
Right. Yeah, I wish it was her the whole time at the end, and I would have loved that. Because that to me screams the original name for the film, Switchblade Romance. Mm-hmm. But like,
which they chose not to use because Aja thought it was too, I want to say campy is the word he used. Yeah.
Yeah, he used campy. And I was like,
I also feel like I feel like people in North America would have had more difficulty. Like, I can imagine them saying, oh, audiences won't understand what we're talking about, even though you think about it, like, Switchblade Romance is a far significant, it's not just better, but it's also more reflective of what the film is actually doing.
We're switching back and forth.
Right. It's kind of like the same thing that they even did for Ganja and Hess in the States by calling it Ganja and Hess when the original title was Blood Couple. Yeah. It was just like that whole concept of like, oh, they're not going to truly understand based off of the fact that not only are they blood coupled because they're vampiric, it's also by the frame of them being from the same kind of ancestry of being black and things like that. But we ain't talking about Ganja Hess, we're talking about high tension. She takes off the binding, smiling and cheering for Alex. Alex has a knife in her hand, screaming for Marie to not touch her. Marie tries to convince her that he's dead, but Alex doesn't understand. Crying for her to get out, they get out of the truck. Marie's still trying to convince her, but Alex wants no part of it, asking about her family. We go through flashbacks of Marie slaughtering her entire family.
That's the only thing we get. We only get the flashbacks of the family slaughter.
That's it.
Honestly, you make this a two-movie thing where the halfway mark is where we get the twist, and then we rewind, and then we get the entire movie from what really happened.
It's just like pictures of Jimmy like looking at her as she crawls in, and then she like walks back and he's like, what is this bitch doing?
Right. I mean, because have y'all ever seen that Helen Hunt movie, I See You, that came out a year or two ago? I'm not going to spoil anything, but
I haven't seen it.
It's basically a movie where like you see, it's really good. But
that's what I hear.
Where it happens, and then the halfway point, it basically rewinds and you see the entire movie again from someone else's perspective.
Oh, that's fucking awesome.
I like it, but again, some people are like, well, this is boring because we're just seeing the whole movie again. Mm-hmm. So your mileage may vary. I think it's really effective.
Yeah, fair enough. Marie claims that it has nothing to, Marie claims that it was nothing she could do to save them, asking for Alex to calm down. She slashes Marie's face and stabs her in the stomach, causing her to shift back into her alternate self. Alex makes a run for it through the woods. Marie as the man, pulling the knife out of her gut and grabbing a chainsaw from inside the truck.
This is where your problematic element comes back to, though, because it's because she was rejected. So she gave in to her lesbian desires and was rejected, and now she's a killer again. So that's again us queers are so desperate for love that when we're rejected, we're going to turn psychotic.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Revving it as he screams, she can't escape. They run through the forest, Marie switching back and forth from herself and the man. Alex runs out on the road, causing a man to stop his car, the man from earlier. The same scenario that we got earlier in the film. She bangs on his window for help, but the man comes closer with a chainsaw. She gets inside of his car, pleading for him to drive. He is so confused.
But his engine stalled.
He's just like, he's like, wait, what the fuck is going on? He runs on top of the roof, smashing the saw through the window, splitting the man as the blood showers the back seat as Alex screams.
So for y'all, I don't know, because this was a shortened scene for the rated cut as well. In the unrated cut, we get a lot more shots of the saw.
So much of his stomach.
Making contact with his stomach, yeah.
So much more contact. And you actually see him like screaming and flailing and all that stuff.
I'm assuming in the rated cut, it's more just the blood splashing on Alex's face as she's screaming. Yeah.
You get, so you very get intense. One, damn.
Yeah, you get one slight slash of the stomach towards the end, but that was about it.
That unrated cut, it lingers it's on going that in saw. There.
It's going in there. He is flailing. He is a wacky inflatable tube man. He goes back to he goes to the back, bursting the chainsaw through the window. She screams, him stopping to mock her. And I actually do like the mocking portion of him, where like in my mind, it's just thinking of just like Maria's like completely over it. She's just like, no, like, you shouldn't even be screaming right now.
But this is even a different side for the killer, right? Because, again, before this, the killer was never, Marie, was never going to kill Alex. Right. And so this is, like, this is the only time where it's like, oh, this is, like, full tilt done. Like, she's lost it because she's been rejected.
Exactly. She grabs a weapon and tries to make another attempt to escape. He notices her crawling away on the road. Alex has a shard of glass stuck in her Achilles tendon. She pulls it out, trying to still get away. Now, this was all there in both rated R and unrated. He comes closer, revving the chainsaw, asking Alex if she loves him, asking the question, quote, "You don't love me, do you?" end quote, over and over again. She cries that she does, with the chainsaw teasing her. The chainsaw is cut as the man kneels down, transitioning back into Marie, kissing her. Alex stabs her with the tire iron, Marie whispering, quote, "Nothing will come between us, never again. I won't let anyone come between us anymore," end quote. She rubs Alex's face as we fade to Marie in cuffs, repeating the saying over and over again. She sits there, rocking back and forth, Alex behind a double-sided window, touching the glass. She asks someone if she can see her. Marie looks right at her, reaching out for her from the other side. One last jump scare, why not?
Then, I do like credits. That as a closer. I do like
Me
that.
Me too.
Really? You I like love that as a closer. Thing where it doesn't make any sense that she can see someone behind
Oh, no. I mean, no. I'm sorry. Her love for her is so strong. She senses her because she's a
connection.
She's a magic lesbian. no, I just. She's like doing thriller.
So good. Oh, man. Well, that was high tension. It's a fucking ride of a movie. And for a first view, I did like it.
Oh, yeah.
I did very much remember enjoying the fuck out of this movie and thinking it was the coolest shit ever at the time. And then I started seeing things like Martyrs and stuff like that. Because Modern French Extremity was really hard for us to get in the States at that time, too. But I do agree with y'all where you said that High Tension kind of put Modern French Extremity on the map for the U.S.
I mean, oh my god, sorry, hold on. I have it. I mean, it was on the Wikipedia. But yeah, it was basically because it went to TIFF in the Midnight Mass section in 2003, and this is actually from Alexander West's book as well, Joe, but it says, "The screening of High Tension and Midnight Madness made that section of the film festival an unintentional bastion for New French Extremity, which still did not have a popular following. Following High Tension's release there, other films followed at the festival, such as Calvaire, Shaitan, Frontiers, Inside, and finally Martyrs."
Fuck. God, Inside. Wow. What a flick. That's interesting. But I got some movie facts for us, and these are provided by IMDb. So, grain of salt. The camera used during the car attack scene got so much fake blood on it during the shooting that when it was being used by someone else for another film, the blood was oozing out of the camera when the camera would heat up.
That's amazing.
I love that.
That's fantastic. According to Aja, the scene where Marie hides from the killer in the gas station restroom is homage to the similar scene in Maniac.
Yes, he says that on the commentary.
Okay, that's
cool.
And
that is my favorite scene in this film, by the way, is the
fair enough.
The bathroom
it's a
stuff.
Cut scene. It's a good scene. The shot where the fake blood splatters the camera lens during the murder of the driver was actually an accident, but the shot impressed the director, Alexander Aja, so he just left it in the film. The graphic shot was cut from the theatrical release, though, but was restored to the DVD release. Bloody hell. All right. This movie was shot in 36 days.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, impressive.
And I think shot in like Romania as well.
Yeah, it was shot in Romania. Super interesting.
Bucharest, right? Oh no, it's either Budapest or Bucharest.
I don't know. Oh my God. Just remember seeing Romania.
And all the nightlife listeners in Budapest are like,
"Hello,
motherfucker." Now this is one of the ones that I actually have a bit of a gripe with, but we were going to talk about this more in the post show. Influenced by the Dean Koontz novel Intensity, director-writer Alexandra Aja had read the novel prior to making Hot Tension, or High Tension, despite the similarities of Koontz, later elected not to pursue a plagiarism case as because he found the film, quote, so puerile, so disgusting, and so intellectually bankrupt that he didn't want the association with it that would inevitably come if he pursued an action against the filmmaker.
I think he was just lazy. I think he didn't care.
I think so too.
Did y'all read the plot summary for Intensity?
I didn't, but I've always wanted to read Intensity because I've heard that this film was inspired by it. But
Joe, do you want? I mean, just basically, it's just like the setup is the same. Although I don't think there's a queer element to it, right? They're just friends.
Yeah.
But yeah, she goes home to her friend's house to study. Someone comes and kills everybody. The friend does die, though. Basically, the final girl, our de facto Marie, only decides to go after the killer because the killer has a child kidnapped. But the twist ending, there is no real twist. It's just that basically she encounters the sheriff, and the sheriff is the killer. Is no like, oh, the girl that we're following is actually the killer the whole time. Also, she's not a lesbian. She just wants to save this child. So it's really the premise itself and like the first act, I think, that sounds the most ripped off.
Interesting. Okay. Well, that makes sense then. Let's go and do one more. Let's get a slightly juicy one. When the killer first appears on screen, pleasuring himself in the truck, the human head he tosses out of the window is Alex's. So I guess it's supposed to be that reference. Note the dried blood under her nose, the same as when Alex is discovered chained in the bathroom, in the bedroom. That is wrong, according to the director's commentary on the movie. He clearly states that it is not Alex's head, but the kind of girl the killer likes.
Yep.
And if you take a really close look at the decapitated head, you can see that it no longer has front hair strands as Alex. I ain't looking that close. Also, the eyebrows and the lineaments differ from each other.
Someone watched this movie real close.
Yes, mad close. But holy shit, that was high tension. Before we get to the portion of where we're talking about the next film we'll be slightly talking about, Trace and Joe, want to thank you both so much for coming on to the show.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, seriously.
Like, so much great perspective. Like, you guys make me want to see this movie, and I don't want to see it again, but I kind of have to.
Like, I honestly, we wouldn't have been able to break it down like this. So thank you both so absolutely much for coming onto the show.
Thank you. I mean, I feel for your listeners, I promise I'm actually normally a really fun, happy-going guy.
Yeah,
I just really
we always did. It's always a huge prick.
I wanted to rewatch this. It's like, yeah, you know, like maybe I'll like it more. And I kind of hate that I didn't. I liked it less this time. But
that's fair.
You're not getting happy Trace.
Yeah, this one you're getting venti Trace, not happy Trace.
I'm very venti on this episode,
which is completely fine. It is human nature, and in all honesty, you still did pick things that you really enjoyed about this film.
Yeah,
which is
fine.
Awesome.
It's a solid 2.5. Like it
there
is a
you
2.5 out of 5.
I love it. There you go. But Joe and Trace, where can people find you on the internet, my friends?
So we co-host a show called Horror Queers. You can find us every Wednesday in any podcatcher. And if you want to connect with the show, we are on Twitter and Instagram at Horror Queers.
What about you personally, Joe?
Oh, and me personally, I am at B Stole My Remote, and that's the letter B.
And I am at Trace D as in dog Thurman. And again, we are a sister show to Nightlife, Night with a K. We're all in the Bloody Disgusting Podcast Network family.
Yes, so you can all find us all there as well. But this was Nightlight, a horror movie podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Prince, also known as Head Knight. Alongside me, we had Freddy.
Always keeping it spoopy.
Before I get to our efforts portion, the next one we'll be covering is actually going to be The Bride of Frankenstein with BJ Coangelo, which I'm super stoked for as well. Our efforts to get the shot is not enough. We need your help to spread us out to more ghoulish nights. Rating us with 5 stars is very helpful, but we would love for you to recommend the show to someone who would actually enjoy it. You can further support the show on patreon.com/goodnightlife, and that's night with a what?
Hey.
By pledge on Patreon, you have access to the show ad-free and as early as Monday with the post-show. If you don't have any bucks to toss, don't worry. An episode is released every Friday on most podcast services around the world. And remember, everybody, don't forget your nightlight.
Murder in America is a true crime podcast that covers stories from all 50 states, including stories of mass shootings, serial killers, and lesser-known murders. Do you find yourself doing more research after listening to a true crime show? Well, Courtney and I used to do the same thing, and that's why we created Murder in America. Our podcast dives deep into each case. Our storytelling will make you feel like you're right there within the case with us, watching it all play out, and we do not shy away from the graphic details. If you're a fan of true crime, then listen to Murder in America on Spotify now.
Every town has its dark history. Hometown Ghost Stories is a paranormal podcast that goes town to town all across the globe, exploring the world's most haunted places, tapping into the dusty archives and the darkest corners to bring you the most terrifying stories of real people and their harrowing experiences. Hometown Ghost Stories dives into the history of haunted locations and investigates why and how these places earned their terrifying reputation. Rob, Dave, and Jesse go live every Tuesday night after an uninterrupted documentary-style breakdown on the case, followed by an open discussion with live viewers. Subscribe today to listen to Hometown Ghost Stories on your preferred podcast platform or watch the video version on YouTube and now Spotify. Head on over to the Bloody FM podcast network and check out Hometown Ghost Stories, if you're brave enough.